Hello, beautiful people, and welcome to another broadcast of The Urban Shaman Speaks. I am The Urban Shaman, Alex Rutland, coming to you from whatever time, whatever space you're in right now, wherever you might be, because time is an illusion. All right, beautiful people, welcome back to another episode of The Urban Shaman Speaks. I am Alex Rutland, your urban shaman. And this week, we're going into interview number 2 of the Neruda interviews. So as you recall, last time we finished up with interview number 1. So at the start of this second interview, we have a note by Sarah, the journalist. What follows is a session I recorded of Dr. Neruda on December 28th, 1997. He gave permission for me to record his answers to my questions. This is the transcript of that session. This was one of 5 times I was able to tape record our conversations. I have preserved these transcripts precisely as they occurred. No editing was performed, and I've tried my best to include the exact words, phrasing, and grammar used by Dr. Neruda. It is recommended that if you haven't done so, you listen to interview 1 before going into this one, as they do build on each other. So, with no further ado, Sarah begins. Before we begin tonight's sessions, I wanted to tell you that I've listened to last night's tape and have used it to formulate some new questions. I noticed that I was all over the place with regard to my questions, and tonight I'm going to try and stay more focused. So I'm just warning you that if I get off track again, remind me to stay on course, okay? I'll certainly do my best, although I'm not sure what your course is. Well, I guess I'd like to stay more centered on the Wingmakers and the artifacts of their time capsule. That's fine with me, but let me make one clarification first. The ancient Arrow site was labeled initially as an extraterrestrial time capsule, or ETC. However, it is not actually, in my opinion, a time capsule. Good, let's start right there. What exactly is it, in your opinion? The site is part of a larger structure that's interconnected through some means I don't understand. We know there's 7 sites that have been constructed on Earth, presumably in the 9th century. We know that these sites have some defensive purpose, and we know that the site's planners represent themselves as culture bearers, and are most likely representatives from the central race. I hear a lot about defensive weapon, but how can these wall paintings or the music artifacts be considered part of a defensive weapon? We know from our RV sessions that the Wingmakers designed these sites to be more than a defensive weapon. Otherwise, as you point out, the cultural artifacts wouldn't make any sense. However, it also doesn't make sense that they'd be completely unrelated to the objectives of a defensive weapon. I'd make the hypothesis that they're DNA triggers. You mean they activate something within our DNA, as you were describing last night? Correct. And how does this relate to a defensive weapon? It was our hypothesis that the cultural artifacts, if studied or examined, would somehow activate parts of our DNA. For what purpose, we weren't certain, but I intuit that it has something to do with stimulating our fluid intelligence and enabling sensory inputs that have been dormant within our central nervous system. And do you have a hypothesis as to why? Presumably, the enhancements to the central nervous system makes the defensive weapon more effective. It is so damn easy to get sidetracked when talking with you, but I'm going to resist the temptation to move into a line of neurological discourse. Not that I know about it anyway. Tell me more about your role with the Wingmaker's time capsule, or whatever you want to call it. I think for accuracy and consistency, we can refer to it as the Ancient Arrow site. As I said before, I'm confident that it's not a time capsule. To your question, though, I was working with a computer we call ZEMI, Z-E-M-I, helping to translate the data contained on the optical disc found in the 23rd chamber of the site. It contained text, symbol pictures, mathematical equations, and what turned out to be music files. Once the site was located, my primary focus was to decode the optical disc and make the data therein sensible, and as much as possible, applicable to BST. Did any of it apply to BST? Not directly, or at least nothing that I've read. The text was more philosophical in nature. I was the first one to read their language. Once we unlocked the optical disc, we printed out 8,045 pages of symbol pictures like the ones contained in their artwork, except much more varied, and in some instances, much more complex. There were 23 chambers of text or symbol pictures, each consisting of about 350 pages. I read the first segment or chapter of this text and was amazed to find that they were passages of text in the introduction that were only readable to me. This was additional confirmation that I had a role to play in getting this information to the public domain. Are you saying that the text you read disappeared after you read it, or that you deleted it? It disappeared. It deleted itself. So only the first eyes could see the message. Correct. So what did it say? I can recite the exact words if you like, but it would take a few minutes. Give me a summary. The essence of this passage was validating what the ACIO had already known, that the Animus were sending probes in 2011, and it was written in the form of a warning. It stated that the Wingmakers had installed a defensive weapon on Earth that would render the planet invisible to the Animus probes. Invisible? How? They didn't explain with any precision. They wrote that higher frequencies were emanating from the central universe, and that these seven sites comprised a collective technology that somehow coordinated these frequencies, or higher energies, to bring about a shift in the planet's vibratory structure, enabling life on the planet to survive the shift and remain undetected by the Animus. All life forms? Technically, the text didn't specify. And this was for your eyes only. Yes, the Zimi operator did not find any evidence of this section of the text. It completely disappeared. What else did it say? It confirmed that we're dealing with the central race, and that they want the cultural artifacts from the seven sites to be shared with the public. These elements were connected to the effectiveness of the defensive weapon. In what way? In the sense that the materials activate aspects of our DNA that make this shift easier, or perhaps possible. I'm not certain because they were a bit vague. So, by reading the philosophy, I'm supposed to be able to become invisible? I think it's more holistic than that. They left behind poetry, music, paintings, and even a glossary. It seems to me that all of these elements, in addition to the philosophy, are connected. Also, I'm suggesting that something fundamentally changes when these materials are absorbed, and perhaps this change, whatever it is, resonates with the technology from the seven sites. Sounds far-fetched to me. Why do you believe this? I've absorbed the materials and I've noticed changes. Such as? I defected from the ACIO. To me, that's the biggest change imaginable. You're not implying that the materials you read induced you to defect, are you? It was a combination of many things, but it certainly had a significant impact on my decision. Did you read any of the materials I left last night? I read the first section and a little of the glossary. I didn't understand it. It was too abstract. It did have an effect on me, though, and managed to put me out to sleep. I know it's a little intense, but you have to admit it's very interesting. If for no other reason, then they're representative of how our distant ancestors think and believe. And you have a copy of all the pages of text? Yes. And can I see it? Yes, but it's not something I carry around with me. Tell me a bit more about the translation process since you were involved in it. The translation is the key to the usefulness of the optical disc. And using a carefully sequenced set of experiments conducted by Zimi, we were able to access the disk data files in 5 days. How do you know that the translation is correct or accurate? Within the disk, once it is accessed, were translation indexes that enabled their text to print out in perfect English or about 60 other languages. It took us 2 days to figure out how to access the disk, but once we did, we were able to access the 24 sections of text in a span of 17 hours. The most vexing of the translations, and the one in which we have the least confidence, is the music. Good, I'm glad you brought up the music, because I don't understand that element of the time capsule. How do you mean that? Was the music already on the optical disc and you simply captured it from the disc, or was it basically produced by the Labyrinth Group based on the musical notations? Actually, it was a bit of a combination of the two. Their musical notations were very precise, and they left digital samples of each of their instruments, even vocals. So we simply translated their digital samples to a MIDI standard and produced our own version of their music. So were you involved in the music translations as well? Yes, I helped in the initial discovery of their musical notation and helped with the translation indexes. I wasn't involved in its production phase, though I was very curious as to what it would sound like. Can I hear any of these compositions? Yes, of course. When I left, the ACIO had successfully translated 10 of the 23 music compositions. I have these, and they've been converted to both CD and cassette standards. I also have complete files of the remaining 13 compositions in their raw, deconstructed form. How were they produced exactly? Do you mean that technically or artistically? I guess both. On the technical end, we needed to step their samples down to a resolution of 384-bit in order to use them in our computer systems. When we first heard the samples of instrumentation, we were somewhat relieved to hear familiar sounds. There were some that were different, but for the most part, the digital samples that were encoded on the optical disc were the same as contemporary music instruments heard around the world. Once we had captured their samples and organized them into octaves, we took their compositional notations and essentially let the computer select the digital instrumentation based on their samples. Eventually, this all had to be stepped down to 24-bit commercial CD mastering system, which was then pressed on a CD and recorded onto a cassette tape. As for the artistic production, there really wasn't much that we did. The computers did all the interpretive work and essentially performed the production, for that matter. We had some of our staff perform overdubs of various versions to experiment with the compositions. The music was very popular, particularly when you listened to it at a sampling resolution of 384-bit. Didn't anyone wonder why the time capsule included a musical construction kit instead of just having a recording of the music? I mean, why have us bring an artistic interpretation to their music? Everything was wondered about in the Ancient Arrow project. Everything. We didn't know why they did it the way they did it, but again, our hypothesis was that the Wingmakers didn't have a way to bring their music into our world because we lacked the technology to listen to it. So they disassembled their music into, as you put it, a construction kit, which enabled us to reconstruct the music so it could be listened to on our technology. It's the most logical reason. There were several of us who were able to experience Chambers 1 and 2 as a completely integrated form of expression, and it was a very powerful experience, to say the least. When you hear the music in 384-bit resolution with the original painting standing inside the actual chamber in which they were placed, it's a very moving and spiritual experience, unlike any I've ever had. In what way? Just that the sense of being pulled out of your body and into the portal of the paintings is irresistible. There's a very strong sense of movement into and beyond these paintings, and the music and paintings are only two of the art forms. The third, the poetry, is also part of the experience. So tell me about the poetry. The poems are expressed as a wide range of subjects. To most of us at the ACIO, they would have been written by any contemporary poet. There was really nothing that caused them to stand out as representing a culture billions of years older than our own. Many of the same themes about spirituality, love, relationships, and death were evident in the poems as well. There's actually two poems for each chamber painting, so there's a total of 46 poems. That's interesting. Everything else, the paintings, music, artifacts, philosophy, is placed one per chamber. Why do you suppose they've placed two poems in each chamber instead of one? In my opinion, it was to provide a broader perspective into the particular theme represented by a specific chamber. The poetry appears to be designed in such a way to provide both a personal and universal perspective in each of the chambers. But again, it's just a working hypothesis at this time. I assume from the examples you left me that the poetry is also a bit less abstract when compared to the philosophy and paintings. Have you considered how the poetry is related to the paintings? Yes, and I believe that poetry and the paintings have the strongest connection of all objects in each of the chambers. I think the paintings illustrate, in some subtle way, the themes represented in the poetry. In some instances, when the painting represents an ensemble of abstract objects, the poetry is also more abstract. When the painting is more illustrative, the poetry seems more like prose. Are you saying that the poetry carries the central meaning of each chamber? I'm not sure, but it does seem that the poetry is somehow implied symbolically in the chamber painting that it's associated with. The problem is that the poetry is so highly interpretive that it's impossible to know precisely what its theme is intended to be. Also, and I should have mentioned this before, but the grammar and syntax of their language is very different from ours, in that they have no end to their language punctuated with periods. In other words, if we made a literal translation, there would be no sentence structure. more like a logic syntactical approach, which simply means an abstracted language flow, which would be, for most people, very difficult to understand. When I was doing the translations of the poetry, I placed it in a sentence structure that fragmented its meaning so that I could better understand. Perhaps in the process, I unintentionally changed the meaning, but it was either that or the poetry would be too abstracted to understand. Is there a connection between the poetry and the philosophy of each chamber? My colleague and I felt that all of the aspects and objects within a specific chamber were connected, probably in ways we couldn't fathom. We were constantly worried that the translation indexes were somehow inaccurate, and that this was limiting our ability to see the linkages between the various objects. And of course, the most puzzling connection was the technology artifacts, because we had no way to probe or reach any conclusions about their purpose or function. Let's talk a little bit about artifacts found in each chamber. The only one that I've really heard about was the one found in the 23rd chamber, the optical disc. I know you've shown me some photos of the others, but could you describe them better? The optical disc is the only artifact of the 23rd we found that the ACIO had successfully accessed, at least that I'm aware of. The other artifacts were all taken to the Labyrinth Group's research laboratory in Southern California immediately after they were discovered. These were never acknowledged to anyone below a security level 12 clearance. There were rumors within the broader ACIO that there were technologies within the Ancient Aero site, but these never gained any serious consideration, and certainly not by the NSA. The technology artifacts were of the greatest curiosity to 15 because they represented possible solutions to BST. And as I mentioned earlier, 15 and most of the Labyrinth Group, for that matter, felt that the Wingmakers may not allow the Labyrinth Group to deploy BST. Hence, 15 considered the Wingmakers as possible foes instead of allies. But what I've seen doesn't look very advanced or based in high technology. They could pass for crystals or rocks or something organic. Why was the Labyrinth Group so intrigued by them? The crystalline structures that were found, in most cases, did look quite ordinary in the sense that when they were examined by the eye, they appeared to be crystals. But when you looked at them through various molecular and atomic analysis, it was obvious they were man-made objects. In other words, they had synthetic crystalline structures. And we held the hypothesis that they were encoded with information, much like the optical disc or the paintings. We also held the hypothesis that they were potentially connected to the optical disc since it was the last of the artifacts and seemed the equivalent of a keystone or master key. Did any of the texts translated from the optical disc refer to the other artifacts? No, to our disappointment, there were no references. You didn't answer my question about whether you felt there was a connection between the technology artifacts and the specific cultural artifacts related to each chamber. Sorry, I guess it's my turn to get sidetracked tonight. Anyway, yes, there are connections. We were certain of this, but at the same time, because we couldn't get inside the artifacts and probe them, we couldn't prove our theory. Consequently, we placed all of our time and energy on the optical disc because it seemed to be the most important of all artifacts, as well as the one we had the best chance of accessing through our technology. Why? You must bear in mind that the technology artifacts were extremely alien to our technologies. Other than the optical disc, the other technologies were a combination of synthetic materials based on organic structures, and in some instances actually possessed human DNA within their structures. Wait, you're saying that the technologies were in part human? Yes, in a way. But what I was going to say is that these artifacts seem to have molecular-based computer systems that activated by a specific human touch. And we weren't certain whether it was literally a specific human, or a specific type of human, or perhaps any human in a specific state of emotion or mind. We had 115 possible experiments developed for testing, and all failed. But this is real odd. Why would human DNA be inside a technology? And this talk about synthetic crystals, it leaves me cold. We had some similar misgivings until we were able to translate some of the text within the optical disc. The philosophical papers from Chambers 1 and 2 convinced us that the Wingmakers would indeed be authentic, and we had no other reason to disbelieve their story. That's not to say that we suspended all of our disbelief or caution, but the philosophy was a breakthrough to our understanding of their perceived mission with contemporary humankind. I don't know. I read the first two philosophy papers you left for me, and I could believe that they're from an alien race. I could also believe that they're from a deceptive race that uses philosophy and all this cultural stuff to lull us into believing they're benevolent, when in fact they're not at all. I mean, isn't that part of the prophecy you spoke about last night? Well, I see you remain the ever-skeptical journalist. I'm actually glad to see that reaction. Sarah, all I can tell you is that when you take into account all of the cultural artifacts found within the ancient Aros site, and you immerse yourself in their content and philosophy, it's hard to believe they originate from evil intent. Unless that's exactly what they wanted you to believe. Perhaps. It's hard to debate such a thing. I think at some point it's an individual decision. The Labyrinth Group, and I'm including the Cordium when I say that, was in agreement that it was an authentic disclosure from the Central Race, and felt confident that we were not dealing with deception. But we never closed the door to that possibility. Our security and operations directors put contingency plans in place in the event evidence was accumulated that increased the probability of fraud or deception. One of the things that seemed odd to me, having looked at the photographs of the chamber paintings, was how similar they all were. They were clearly done by the same artist, or I suppose a group of artists. But when I think of a time capsule, I would think you would include a variety of art from a diverse assortment of artists that represent a variety of perspectives and so forth. And that isn't the case here. Why do you suppose? I don't think their motive was to inform us about their artist or the diversity of their artistic culture. I think they intended that the art function initially as a form of communication and subsequently as a form of time travel or moving out of the body consciousness. The continuity of the 23 paintings seen as a whole seemed to be inviting the consciousness of the observer to quite literally step into the world of the Wingmakers, as though they were portals, and I've experienced this myself. The paintings are incredibly brilliant in their colors. You really can't imagine how much impact they have when you see them in person, particularly after their cleaning and restoration was completed. But even when the very first discovery happened, without any touch-up, it was eerie how luminous they were and vibrant in their colors after 1,150 years. There were many times when those of us who were involved in restoration and cataloging of the artifacts would sit in the chambers and stare at these paintings. On several occasions, I did this for hours, just letting my eyes wander through the painting and imagining the mind of the artist and what they were trying to communicate. It was a very powerful experience. I think they'd scare me a little bit. Understand, I'm only laughing because I had such an experience. One night after a long day of working in the artifact chamber, I was left as the last one inside the site. I had been so absorbed in what I was doing, I scarcely remember being told to activate the security system on my way out. About a half hour went by, and I finally realized I was alone inside the time capsule. The silence was incredible. At any rate, I was walking down the corridor that connected all the 23 chambers and past each chamber, and I began to feel a presence that was overwhelming. Every time I would come upon one of the chambers, I expected something from the painting to jump out at me. They literally seemed alive. Our lighting was a very high-quality portable halogen system, and every chamber was outfitted precisely the same. When I got to the bottom of the corridor, what we called the spiral staircase, and looked into chamber 2, I clearly saw motion and nearly jumped out of my skin. Not necessarily out of fear, but out of excitement. I suppose, though, there was fear as well. But this motion was simply a blurred image of something stepping out of the painting and then disappearing into thin air. What was it? Was it human? I couldn't see it clearly enough to tell you what it was. But I began to theorize that some of the chamber paintings may have purposes beyond just visual stimulation. Our RV also had some experiences of sensing motion in the paintings, feeling as though she was being pulled out of her body. This may seem to be an odd off-the-wall question, but how do you know this wasn't all a hoax? That someone or some group created this whole thing to look like an alien or future time capsule just for the fun of playing with your minds? The one thing we know for certain is that this is not a hoax. The ancient Aros site consists of an enormous rock structure that has literally been hollowed out in the form of a helix that detours every 10 meters into a separate chamber, 23 to be exact. The entire structure would have taken an incredible technology to build. We have accurate dating of when the chamber paintings were created, and they were conclusively produced in the 9th century, and we're certain that this technology did not exist then. I'm not trying to argue with you, but if these artifacts were really from the Central Race, it just seems so odd that they'd be buried inside a huge rock in the middle of nowhere. In New Mexico, of all places. And it also seems odd that they go to all this work, but make it so damn hard to understand what the hell they were trying to say. Do you see what I mean? Yes, I understand. And I don't take your questions as argumentative. But the point I'm making is that this site is indeed a set of real objects. And these objects don't even correspond to the same time frame. For example, while the paintings were created about 1,100 years ago, the artifacts do not even respond to our carbon dating or biochemical analysis. To complicate matters, the pictographs in and around the ancient Aero site were determined to have been created in the past 50 years, and could very well have been done in the year or month the site was discovered. These real objects are admittedly an enigma, but they are not a hoax to my eyes. The real question is whether the Wingmaker's identity and purpose is as they represent it. Okay, let's say it's not a hoax. Then tell me why you're so convinced it's a defensive weapon. Seems to me that it might be more of a communication device, or perhaps an educational tool of some kind. Why a weapon? The text from the optical disc states this, and we had an RV session that corroborated it. So, Earth is this genetic library that the Animists want to use in order to recreate themselves as soul carriers, as you put it. And the ancient Aero site and its six companion sites is going to protect Earth and all of us from these marauding aliens. How am I doing so far? I can't say that your specific conclusions are right or wrong. I can only tell you that the Animists are a real threat and the Wingmakers intend to protect their genetics. Okay, then tell me, why would the central race who lives trillions of light years away care about what happens to us? The central race is responsible for seeding and cultivating higher life forms throughout the universe. They're vitally interested in protecting their genetics from the Animists. Earth isn't the only genetic repository that they protect in this manner. Our RV sessions uncovered a database of planets throughout our super universe that was incalculably large. So this is just standard operating procedure for this race, to install a defensive weapon on the planets they seed with life. I believe so. I looked the word Animus up in the dictionary this morning. It's a real word. How did a race whose most recent visit to Earth was some 300 million years ago become an entry in Webster's dictionary? Their name is known even by the Wingmakers. They use the same word in their translation indexes. There are certain words that have been purposely seeded within our language by the Wingmakers. So now you're saying that Wingmakers actually place words into our dictionaries? No. Remember when I told you that the Wingmakers were culture bearers? Yes. They have encoded the discovery of language, mathematics, music, and so forth into our genetic structures. And as we evolve, certain forerunners of our species, people like you and I, activate a part of their DNA before the rest of us. These forerunners are able to retrieve this encoded information and share it with the species. In subsequent generations, this insight is transmitted, and pretty soon the entire species encompasses this new information or skill. So you're really saying that the word Animus was encoded into our sense of language, and someone invented the word not realizing it was the name of this alien synthetic race? Yeah, something like that. I also read the memo that Dr. Sothers, a colleague of Dr. Neruda, wrote about global culture being an outcome of this technology from the Wingmaker sites. But how could these objects be used to build a global culture? It seems a little naive to me. All I can tell you is that it's related to the internet and a new communication technology that the Wingmakers refer to as OLIN, or the One Language Intelligent Network. If you read the glossary section that I left behind, you'll see it referenced there. The Wingmakers seem to feel confident that the OLIN technology will help create the global culture through the internet. This, incidentally, is consistent with the prophecies that the Labyrinth group was privy to, dating as far back as 1,500 years ago. Of course, the enabling technology wasn't called OLIN, but the notion of a global culture and unified governance has been predicted for many centuries. This is what George Bush used to call the New World Order, isn't it? Yes, but there have been four other presidents who've acknowledged this concept. What would make the world's people decide to unify under one governing body, or for that matter, create a global culture, whatever that means? I just can't envision it happening, not in my lifetime. According to the Wingmakers, it will happen through the digital economy, and then through the internet's OLIN technology platform. And through this global network, entertainment and educational content will be globalized. This is the basis of a global culture with unified commerce, content, and communities. Once these pieces of the infrastructure are in place, then the need to govern this infrastructure will loom as a preeminent issue of the day. and the United Nations is the logical ruling body for such an endeavor. As long as the world's people allow the digitization of the economy and embrace the Olin technology platform, a global government and culture is virtually assured to emerge. And as you said last night, this is supposed to occur in 2018. According to prophecy, that's when the United Nations will hold initial elections for a unified world government. And it won't be an all-powerful centralized authority, but rather a global public policy decision and enforcement organization for issues that affect the world at large. Issues like pollution, global warming, border disputes, space travel, terrorism, trade, commerce, Olin technology upgrades, and general technology transfer programs. So what will happen to national sovereignty in this new role of the United Nations? I'm willing to answer your question in the form of a speculative response, but I'm also aware that you had asked me at the outset of this interview to remind you if you got off course that you would like, you're absolutely right, sorry. Let's go back to the artifacts. What was the condition of the site when you first entered? Or better still, why don't you just describe your first encounter going inside the site? I was one of five from the ACIO who made the trip to New Mexico to explore the site after it was initially determined to have potential ET implications. None of us at the time knew anything that would have led us to conclude that the Ancient Arrow site would become such an important discovery. The only real clue we had was an artifact that had been recovered near that was determined much later as the entrance of the interior chamber of the time capsule. It was this artifact that brought the project under the control of the ACIO because the artifact was considered by the NSA to have potential ET origins. What specifically led the NSA to conclude the artifact was alien? Like all other artifacts, it showed no response to carbon dating analysis and it had peculiar markings or symbols that seemed otherworldly. It was a pure gray composite of unknown origin. Also, and perhaps even more importantly, there was no obvious way to activate the artifact or access its internal controls. Its interior was impervious to various spectrum analyses. Even simple x-rays were unable to penetrate the object. At any rate, this artifact was essentially handed over to the ACIO, which deemed it to be of ET origins, and then proceeded to investigate the region in which it was found. We discovered that the outside casing of the artifact held a detailed topographical map that defined the region in which it was discovered. We began to think the artifact might activate or become more useful if taken to the region depicted on its casing. Is this the artifact you showed me pictures of? No, this artifact destroyed itself after it led us to the Ancient Arrow site. Why did you think it was important to activate it where it was found? Because it was thought to be a form of a compass or homing beacon. We weren't sure, but we couldn't determine any functional purpose in the laboratory, so it seemed like a logical experiment to see how the device would function in the area in which it was discovered. Also, the original people who found the artifact complained that it induced a hallucinogenic experience when it was held near the stomach area. The exploration team from the ACIO figured out how to use this device to locate the entrance to the interior of the canyon wall in which the Ancient Arrow site was hidden. The device, when activated, seemed to pass through waves of or mental pictures of where it wanted the person to go. The RV assigned to our team was the one holding the device when it was first activated, and she immediately began to see pictures. I did as well. Ultimately, it led us into a cave-like structure tucked 20 to 30 meters inside one of the clefts of the canyon wall. Was there an entrance already, or did you have to blast your way inside? The way into the interior was cleverly hidden behind a natural-made cavern, which in its own right was well hidden by natural underbrush. This cavern was about 25 meters deep and led inside the canyon wall. We presumed it was an Indian dwelling of some kind that had been abandoned. Towards the end of this cavern, there was a corridor that jutted off to the side, and at the back of this corridor, there was another chamber. A large flat rock on the floor hid the entrance to the site. So you were convinced there was something underneath the rock? Yes. After removing the rock, we were able to determine a tunnel was indeed beneath it. The tunnel was in the form of a letter J and was about 1 meter in diameter. I slid down first through the tunnel and crawled my way to the entrance of the site. So all five of you were inside this site, looking around with flashlights. What was running through your mind at the time? We were all very excited and somewhat apprehensive as well. We thought we might find an ET site, and were half aware that it could be an active site, which kept us all on our guard. And this whole thing was carved out of rock? It was completely man-made, or alien, and we knew it the instant we got out of the transition tunnel. It was like being born into a completely new world. It was absolutely silent. The air was cool, but not uncomfortably cold. There were no signs of life, and it seemed like everything took on a new purpose, an intelligent purpose that we couldn't wait to unravel. What was so remarkable was the incredible sense of walking into a surreal world, a world that it was created by something completely alien. We assumed it was an ET construction from the moment we stepped out of the J-Tunnel. But how did you immediately know it was artificial construction and not a set of natural chambers or caves? At the beginning of the spiral staircase, there were ornate pictographs carved in the stone with precision never before seen by our eyes. Also, the entire tunnel system was clearly too smooth, almost polished, to be of natural construction. There was a sense of architecture, a sense that someone designed it with extreme care and purpose. Amazingly, there was nothing on the floor, not even a pebble or a grain of sand. Every surface was completely clean, smooth, and polished. There was dust, but only dust, and something like a polymer coating that had been applied to every square centimeter of the entire structure, including the ceilings. When we arrived at the first chamber, which is only about 30 meters from the entrance, I can clearly recall a sense of awe, or something approaching a religious experience, I suppose. No one spoke for a long time after our lights hit the first chamber painting. Everyone's flashlight converged on the painting, and we all just stared for about 40 seconds in the incredible silence of this tomb-like structure. Did you find all the chambers that same day? Yes, we went from chamber to chamber, each time feeling like we had stumbled onto an alien natural history museum. You have to understand that our lighting was not very good because we hadn't expected to need anything more than basic flashlights. I vividly remember seeing each of the chamber paintings for the first time and just staring at them, mesmerized by their incredible anachronism of the place. I'd never been in such a surreal environment. It was both eerie and completely enchanting at the same time. So how large were the chambers and the paintings themselves? The chambers themselves were relatively small, about 4 meters in diameter with fairly high ceilings, in some instances as high as 6 meters. So judging from the photographs I've seen of the chamber paintings, the paintings themselves must be fairly large. Yes, they're large and always face the entrance of the chamber. If you stand just outside the entrance of a particular chamber, you can't see the whole painting. It's too large. You have to walk into the chamber in order to see the whole composition. What, in the opinion of the Labyrinth Group, are the artistic merits of these paintings? No one within the Labyrinth Group claims to be an art critic, I can assure you. I think it's fair to say that those who saw the chamber paintings in their original environment found the artistic merits to be very compelling, even captivating. I think those who saw them only represented in photographs thought they were less art and more of a cog in some masterfully designed wheel, like an illustration in a children's book. Not to change the subject, but I keep wondering how you came to choose me. I mean, I know you said it was completely random, but why did you select an average journalist to share this story? Why not a scientist or someone who could at least ask you more sophisticated questions? I have to confess that I feel completely inadequate to interview you, mostly because I don't even know what questions I should be asking you. You're doing a fine job. Absolutely fine. You shouldn't worry about your questions. They're insightful. And most people who will read this information, or listen to it, will be more interested in the things you've inquired about than the physics or science involved anyway. Perhaps. But I have this nagging feeling that if I could ask you the scientific questions, then you could more easily prove your story or credibility. I think I'm handicapping you in some way. Well, what is it exactly that you feel you're not asking me? I guess it's mostly things related to time travel and BST. Last night you talked about some things that when I reread them earlier today, I felt like I should have asked more in-depth questions. Like? That's the problem. I don't know. Sarah, the reason I selected you was simple. I needed to find someone who knew how to access the mainstream media and yet be relatively obscure. Had I chosen a science editor from a major newspaper, I may have ended up with more scientific questions and less about the cultural, artistic, and social applications and implications of the Ancient Arrow project. Of my random selections, I knew that you had no established image to protect, that you knew how to access the media, and could ask sound questions that wouldn't betray your identity. That's why we're talking right now. And the fact that you didn't think I was crazy. I never asked you this before, but I'm just curious. Was I the first journalist you talked with, or did someone turn you down before you found me? No, You were the first and only person outside of the Labyrinth group whom I've talked with about this story. Well, I'd like to change the topic slightly and ask you about 15's personality. Is that okay? Yeah, that's fine. What's he like as a leader? He's extremely focused and demands everyone he works with to be similarly focused. He's a workaholic, sleeps about 4 hours a night, and works the rest of his time on some aspect of BST. If there's research or development of new technologies that don't have a specific and strategic impact on BST, he's not involved in it. He won't even ask questions about projects of that nature. And generally within the ACIO, there are always three or four projects that are unrelated to BST. Within the Labyrinth group, every project is related to BST. What's he look like? He's about average height and has fairly long gray hair down to his shoulders, which he usually wears in a ponytail. He's always reminded me of Pablo Picasso with long hair. He has those same penetrating eyes. He's originally from Spain, so it's no coincidence that he looks like Picasso. His most notable feature is his eyes. They're mischievous like you'd expect from a child who's done something wrong on the surface, but underneath they've created something wonderful. It's just that nobody understands the wonderful part yet. That what you see going on behind his eyes. I may have already asked you this, but how old is he? He's about 60 years old, I think. Or at least he looks about that old. I've never heard anyone say his age. I know when he was a student, he was supposed to look old for his age. I think he started getting gray hair when he was in his early 20s. That's probably why he was often mistaken for a professor rather than a student. You said earlier that he was kicked out of school. Why? Remember, he was, even at an age when most kids were concerned about dating and parties, working on BST. Or at least early versions of time travel. He's one of those rare visionaries that enter the physical world and know at a very early age what he came to do. 15 was born to time travel, period. End of story. That's all he's ever cared about. In the 50s, researching BST was considered a waste of time, no pun intended. It was simply too theoretical and disconnected from anything practical. I think 15 also rubbed his professors the wrong way because he was so bright as a student that he intimidated most of them. He was also very stubborn. And when the professors told him to change his research to something more practical, 15 apparently told them they were small-minded or something to that effect. Later that semester, he was forcibly expelled, as the story was told to me. However, Bell Labs hired him for a short stint because his research on quantum objects and how they could be influenced by consciousness interested them. Forgive me, but what exactly are quantum objects? They're elementals like electrons or neutrons. Quantum objects are fundamental building blocks of matter, and they can appear both as a wave and a particle. Okay, so 15 was trying to prove that quantum objects were influenced by consciousness. Why was that so dangerous to research university? That in itself wasn't so radical, but it was only a small part of his total research into how to construct BST using the new physics that was being introduced rapidly in the community of quantum physics. 15 has always maintained that Einstein's general theory of relativity was flawed, which is not a popular position to take. In somewhat the same way that Newton's theory of the mechanistic universe became too constricted and unable to explain so much of the phenomenon of what we call today complexity or chaos theory. 15 felt that Einstein's theories underestimated the influence that consciousness had on quantum objects. In the 50s and 60s, this was tantamount to heresy, particularly because it was impossible to prove by mathematical modeling or formula. Consequently, 15 just continued to develop his theories in secret and began to become noticed by the ACIO when he became involved in a project having to do with heuristic learning systems based on a technology that the ACIO had re-engineered from the Greys. The project leader from the ACIO recognized his intellect and rogue creativity and began to develop a relationship with the young man. Several months later, 15 was recruited to join the ACIO and essentially left his identity behind, quickly rising to the position of director of research. He was later introduced to the Quartium Intelligence Accelerator technology. And the rest is history, as they say. How exactly did this Quartium Technology Accelerator expand the intelligence? Few people realize that their conscious mind only processes about 15 bits of information per second of linear time. However, in vertical time, the unconscious mind is processing approximately 70 to 80 million bits of information. Thus, in normal consciousness, humans are aware of only an infinitesimal amount of the information that is constantly being fed to them at an unconscious level. The Quartium technology was designed to reduce the filtering aspects of the conscious mind and enable the higher frequency information packets to be fed to the conscious mind. In parallel with this effort, the brain circuitry, if you will, is rewired to handle the higher voltage of the information that is being fed into the consciousness, allowing capabilities like photographic memory and abstract thought to coexist. These capabilities become the matrix filter that draws from the unconscious repositories the most relevant information at any particular time based on a problem or task at hand. If I were a behavioral scientist, I'd be able to ask you about 1,000 questions right now, but I'm lost in what to say. I mean, how many bits of information can you process right now? It's not really a simple question of the quantity of information processing, but rather the relevance of the information in linear time based on the intention of the individual. When one goes through the process of the Cordium technology, their ability to tune into information packets that are relevant to a situation or problem is vastly improved. And most people, when a given situation confronts them, they access their conscious mind and pull out the solution that has served them in the past. Thus, people fall into ruts and pattern behaviors, which closes down their access to the unconscious information packets that are based on real-time situation analysis and have extremely high relevancy. This technology accelerates the circulation of information between the conscious and unconscious aspects of the mind to flow in the pattern of an ascending spiral rather than the pattern of a repetitious circle. And because of this, it unleashes the innate intelligence of the individual. So you see, the Cordium technology doesn't increase raw intelligence. It simply facilitates the natural intelligence of the individual. This is very cool. I wish I could undergo this regimen of the Cordium Intelligence Accelerator so I could really ask you some zinger questions. And with that, let's take a short break. All right, beautiful people. We're going to stop here for today with section one of the second interview, of the Neruda interviews. And we'll see you soon. This has been another broadcast of The Urban Shaman Speaks with your urban shaman, Alex Rutland. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. Until next time, step outside the illusions of time, space, and even this matrix reality, and seek the truth within.